Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital. Today, I am so thrilled to be having this discussion with Greg Francis. I met Greg at an event maybe a month and a half ago. I am ashamed to say that I did not know of Greg and the case that he was involved in. And so once I heard him speak, saw that he had written a book and about what he did, I'm like, okay, I've got to interview him. So Greg began his legal career in 1994 as an associate with a statewide defense firm specializing in medical malpractice defense, nursing home defense, and municipal defense. In 2018, Greg joined longtime friend and colleague Joseph Osborne in forming their own firm, Osborne and Francis. And also, he was awarded the, and this is a long title here, the Vince Monroe Townsend Legends Award by the National Bar Association for his historic leadership in the area of civil rights and designated as a game changer by Politic 365. And you're going to learn more about what this is. Greg Francis currently serves as lead counsel for the Black Historic Farmers case, which is monumental, which is unfortunately the case that I knew nothing about a month and a half ago.
Right.
So welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you for having me, Jeff.
All right. So we've got a few questions here. This is what we ask all of our guests. We're going to use this as a framework. We could go many directions here. We've already had some discussions before, right, and this is going to be fascinating. So tell us a little about where you grew up, where you went to school, and then just high level of your career.
I'm originally from Panama in Central America. I'm the descendant of Caribbean workers who were brought into Panama to build the Panama Canal. So we have I have a very strong background in that. And my great grandparents left different islands to come to Panama. So I feel like it's embedded in me a sense of entrepreneurship, a sense of wanting something new and going to new places. So originally born in Panama, when we moved to America, we moved here to Orlando. So I grew up here in Orlando, Florida, attended public school here, participated in sports. I was a football player and a track athlete in addition to being a student. Ended up at the University of Florida, where I did my undergraduate and law school. While I was in law school, I did a clerkship one summer, as law students do. And it just so happened that my clerk supervisor was Joe Osborne. So that's how the connection was initially okay. Born between the two of us. And he ultimately left the firm. I left the firm, but we remained friends throughout the entire time. I've spent the majority of my career handling cases, catastrophic injury cases of all sorts. We currently specialize in a lot of device litigation, dealing with hips that fail, knees that fail, mesh, that type of thing, class actions and whatnot. And we've been in existence since 2018. I tried a bunch of cases. I've opened offices all over the United States of America for a firm that I was formerly with, currently finishing up this Black Farm case that I knew nothing about. Mm-hmm. You know, so you apologize for not knowing anything about it, but I'm being honest, I didn't know anything about it either growing up. Mm-hmm. I only learned of this case, plight of farmers, and what they had to go through and deal with through my travels and my time I spent in Mississippi.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you some more questions. If they lead into this case, wonderful. If not, I'll come back okay. and we'll get into the case.
Okay.
So how would you best describe yourself in the context of where you are at in your life journey?
I think I've just, you know, since 2018, this is a new transition, and it's almost a transition from entrepreneurship and necessarily trying to get ahead to purpose. Anything that I do now, whether it's professionally or socially, I try to think of what is the purpose of this and how is this going to effectuate my life and the life of others going forward. So I'm really at a point now where any initiatives that I get behind or I participate in are those that I can see that there's going to be kind of a secondary gain. And that secondary gain is that I look for improvement of society as a whole.
Let's dive in for a second on the case. And if you can give us a little background, because I'm assuming you're doing your normal job and somehow you get introduced to this case, had no clue that would blow up to be this as big as it is. So maybe give some context of how it all started and then what the case was all about.
Right. Part of the my old firms had an initiative of expansion into other areas and other states, other cities. Initially was Florida, but then Atlanta, and then ultimately Mississippi that I was involved in. So as I was building the business in Mississippi, and being that my business was focused on helping consumers who had been injured as a result of someone else's negligence, we started getting calls of farmers who were inquiring as to whether we could help. Was there any help that we could offer to them for their plight, for their fight for recognition of, hey, my life matters too, my farm matters too, I grow the same produce as
so can you give us some examples of what those calls would have been?
I've had farmers drive from Oklahoma and from Texas to tell me about the status of their farm, what they were farming, and how they were losing the farm or had lost the farm because of the lack of funds that had been made available to them. These funds were from the USDA, and they were supposedly to help prop up the agricultural base, you know, in America. I think it was recognized very early on, and I agree with, that food is so important to America and the stability of any sovereignty that the government decided that it was important to make sure there were subsidies to make sure that we could have a very steady source or sources of food. So with that said, there were taxpayer dollars that were designated to go to farmers to help them maybe buy crops or buy the seed for crops, buy right. equipment, buy additional land, bring in enough labor to assist them in the farms. But unfortunately, in this case, and what happened is some of the frontline and mainly the frontline workers at the extension offices had different ideas about where the money should go. Here you have a lot of times individuals who are not necessarily farmers, but now they have been empowered with the ability to say yes or no with these funds to whoever they wanted. Through the course of America, you know, sin got involved. Mm-hmm. And those people who were put in charge of deciding who to loan the money to, that it continuously happened, and it became something that affected the entire system.
Do you think those individuals consciously did this? Was it a?
I think it was almost a sign. I don't want to say a sign of the times, but it was the thought process of the time.
Okay,
you know, African Americans had been freed from slavery, but it wasn't, you know, and that was a change in legislation, but there wasn't a change of heart in thinking, okay, well, now this is my equal. No, there were still thoughts that the black farmers were not equal and therefore not worthy of the award, not worthy of the loans and that type of thing. And then, you know, just, you know, again, it's not something that was born out in D.C. and they decided, hey, we're going to exclude the black farmers. But it became so prevalent amongst the different farm agencies that it almost became a routine of not allowing the farmers to get, you know, the funds that were being provided to everyone else.
If you could rewind, and this pot of capital is available for black farmers and for all farmers, let's just say, the intention sounded great.
Right.
How would you have changed it so that it didn't happen the way that it happened?
It would be, it really is about the people who were put in place. I mean, you know, look, let's be honest. The majority of plantations were in the South. That had become embedded for hundreds of years of kind of this slave master mentality. And then there's a change in legislation that says, hey, you can't do that anymore. But we're still going to put in charge the same people who thought that we should have slaves and not. So I think that there needed to be more of an investment in the actual people who are going to be implementing the farms or the aid for the farms. You know, interestingly, in researching in my book, after Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation, it was his intent to provide land from Charleston, South Carolina, all the way down to St. Augustine, kind of that coastal land and give it to Black farmers and give them the opportunity to go out there and now be the entrepreneurs and whatnot. We know 6 days later he was shot and killed, and Andrew Jackson became the president, and he was a former governor of Tennessee and didn't quite see it the same way that Lincoln saw it.
Mm.
So, you know, I think to myself in doing the research, how different would it have been if that land would have been granted to Black farmers? And part of it was that they were going to be given the opportunity to either govern themselves or to have someone else come in, but more likely not govern themselves there. So how would that have changed America? In 1920, there were probably 960,000 Black farmers feeding probably 30% of the population of America and really only being 14% of all farmers. How would that have changed if those farmers were empowered and invested in? Because it was already a good return, the return of, you know, was 14% of Black farmers, but serving 30% of the food. What would have happened with America? What would have happened with race relations that we deal with now today, if in fact they had been invested in and given an opportunity to proliferate?
I got to stay focused because I could ask million questions on all this. Right. So then fast forward, what happened to the case? Where are you at? Where is it at today? Give people an update on this case.
The case was initially filed in 1996, and it involved discrimination really from 1981 to 1996. We were able to create kind of a loophole to get around the statute of limitations because during that particular time, there were not offices that of civil rights offices that a Black farmer could complain to. There were boxes and boxes and boxes of complaints that went unanswered during that period of time. And then ultimately, suit was filed, and the USDA very quickly said, okay, once they started doing some of the investigation and hearing some of the stories and uncovering, looking actually in their own archives and seeing the number of complaints that were out there, they decided that, yes, they would, in fact, resolve the case. Problem with that is there was a very tight time frame wherein the farmers had to respond. And you know, for those who are not familiar with rural America, it's a little better now, but, you know, you got to think back to the 90s and 80s and even early 2000, you know, the internet was not proliferating. And even now, you know, there are questions with broadband out there. So there was a disconnect. And when the information went out to the farmers that, in fact, the USDA was going to address their concerns, many of them really, you know, just didn't believe it.
Hmm.
The agency that had discriminated against them for so long, that they'd gotten such bad treatment for so long.
Learned helplessness.
Right, right, exactly. Mm-hmm. They didn't participate. So the case was settled, portion of the case was settled, but the vast majority of the farmers who had been really affected by this did not participate. And there was a struggle back and forth with the USDA as to whether they were going to let, you know, this half justice go or whether they were going to address the entire thing. So subsequent to that, we got involved in the case. There was a provision put in the 2008 Farm Bill that provided for at least a fund. No one thought it was going to be enough money, but there was a provision put in there to compensate those farmers who had not had their cases heard on the merits before. When I got in the case, I became committed to not allowing that to happen again, being the lack of knowledge of the farmers.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I took on a personal crusade of just driving from small town to small town to small town, having press conferences, talking to farmers, talking to farm leaders to ensure that this time around, because I knew this would be it, that everyone who thought they should have participated was going to actually participate in this case. So we did that. The majority of the money has been paid, all of those who have qualified for relief. And that relief was $50,000 per farmer.
Okay.
It was really $50,000 plus $12,500 to pay the taxes on the $50,000
okay.
to each farmer. And it resulted in a result of, you know, $1.25 billion, which is a hell of a lot of money. However, what I learned in talking to the farmers in my travels was that there were things that were lost that I don't know that they're
right.
How to calculate it, how to quantify them.
Yep.
You know, the ability to pass down the generational wealth of the land from one generation to the next, the ability to pass down the knowledge of farming from one generation to the next. what I saw happen a lot of times is the children of farmers, although they worked on the farm, would go away to college and not come back. And there was no one to pass the farm down to. So now you fast forward 10 or 15 years. Yeah, the family owns this land, but the patriarch or the matriarch of the family is gone. And now we have all these kids who are living somewhere else. And they have no intention on coming back and farming. So they sell it off to development or to someone else. So that kind of thing was lost. And then the really family structure that is created on a farm, when you're on a farm and you're a family, everyone has a chore. Everyone has their part they have to do. A lot of times they work together and they play together and they pray together.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of cohesiveness, I think, was also something that was lost as well. So $1.25 billion is a lot of money. And, and I think the important part of that was the acknowledgement by the USDA that, in fact, we hear you. We agree. We have not necessarily been fair to you, but it's certainly not enough to quantify or not enough to satisfy the losses that the farmers ultimately had.
Why haven't we heard about this case?
You know, that I constantly think about that. Why haven't we heard about the case? And I just don't think that much thought is put into. And I thought I kind of turned the question on myself, and I don't think there's much thought put into, you know, where your carrots come from, where your rice comes from, and that type of thing. It's in one sense, the USDA was very successful in that they've created a system with farmers that is so good that we just take it for granted. Go to the grocery store and you buy the food and whatnot, and you don't necessarily pay attention to where it comes from. So I think there's not been a focus on exactly where our food sources come from. But I also think that, you know, there's no glitz and glamour. There's no Henry Ford that started the automotive industry that could be a champion for it. These are salt of the earth folks that were just out there working. I think that, you know, that it's almost a forgotten part of America and forgotten Americans.
Well, and one of the things we briefly touched on for those that are into impact investing, as I told you earlier, there's actually a very significant concern and movement on the farmer in America. So you may not see it.
Right.
I mean, and it may not be a huge contingency, but I will tell you, the more and more people are getting connected with their investment, their capital, and others, we're actually seeing people think about that. Let me give you, I was driving in this morning and I was thinking, why isn't this case out there? I don't like to get into political stuff because I don't think it serves a lot of good, but let me at least, I want to test this out at you.
Sure.
On one hand, those that think that America is not systemically racist, I'm not so sure they want this narrative out there because you see in the context with Black farmers, from what you're saying and what I'm learning, it sounds like a system problem. And maybe if it's a system problem, but maybe it's almost even more of a heart problem.
It is a heart problem.
It's a heart problem.
Yeah.
But I don't think that group really wants to admit that back in 81 to whatever, there was this going on.
Right.
On the other hand, I'm not so sure the other side wants to know that the USDA paid out $1.2 billion because then it proves as well that, well, no, there are some justice being done.
Right.
So I think the two polar sides, they don't really want the story out for multiple reasons. Am I crazy for thinking that?
No, I think you're dead on with that. You know, and with this case, and one of the things that when I got involved in this case, I recognized was going to be an issue and needed to be addressed was I needed to take control of, or we needed to take control of the narrative and not allow someone else to put a narrative on it. Look, during the case, there were allegations of fraud. You didn't really farm. This is all made up. You weren't really a farmer, that type of thing. There were people in Congress who were diametrically opposed to this and any type of compensation whatsoever. So I think that there was a reticence on both sides in terms of getting out there and letting people know about the case. And you're exactly right, because when you hear $1.25 billion and then you kind of turn and say, well, what are you talking about? You got paid. But in the other sense, you know, it's knowledge and awareness that some people just don't want to know about.
Well, and to me, it's truth. The truth is there were issues and problems against Black farmers.
Right.
The truth is you and others fought for it and the USDA paid for it. They tried to make justice. Like, that's actually a story that we need to hear.
Right.
It's truth.
Right. Right. It's truth. And the way I look at it too is, you know, it's an investment. What the USDA did is they invested back in black farmers by granting this money, and it, with the hopes that it could, not that it would cure all the evils of the past, but it was an investment going forward. My focus in life and with this case is, okay, now what do we do going forward?
Yeah.
How do we address this going forward? You know, when you and I talked about this some, I don't think that there's anything wrong with the system. The system is good. That's why we take for granted the food that's available and not really think about it. But it is those who are implementing the system. And, you know, where is their heart? When there's a change in legislation, is there a change of heart? New laws come on the books. Doesn't necessarily mean, okay, well, I used to think this, well, now I'm going to think that. No, you still think what you were thinking before. So it needs to be a conscious effort of really changing the heart and the conversation.
You've done a lot already in your life. How do you connect the dots of this young boy who has roots in Panama, right?
Right.
To then you're now a part of this massive case. Why you?
You know, Jeff, I struggle with this because, you know, just going back a little bit, when I came to America, I didn't speak English very well. I met a friend just down the street. It was a new neighborhood that was being built on the west side of Orlando. Despite the fact that my English wasn't that good, when you're 7, 8 years old, you figure out a way to kind of learn each other and whatnot. He became my very best friend. We went to elementary together and then started middle school together. And he's doing life in prison for murder.
Mm.
So I struggled with, how does someone who caught the same school buses, lived in the same neighborhood, you know, had a two-parent household, how does he end up in prison like that? And how do I end up where I end up? And the one thing that has made it easier for me to swallow is I recognize it's not me.
Mm.
It's grace. Mm-hmm. And it's God's grace.
Mm-hmm.
And my ability to figure that out and acknowledge that has kind of relieved me of some of the guilt, so to speak, of, hey, how did I get to this place? No, but it's all been grace. At every point in my life, there are people who have come into my life that have helped me, and they've not all been black, have helped me along the way and given me an opportunity, given me advice, put me in places and in positions to do certain things. And I recognize that is not by the hand of any man, but it's by the hand of God.
Oh, very well said. You may have already answered this question, but because you've, it's again, I'm pinching myself going, what an amazing conversation to have. And yes, you're an amazing person, so I don't mean to take that away, but just even the circumstances that you've been put in, what a gift.
Right.
Amen. What a gift.
Yeah, amen.
How are you trying to change the world on a go-forward basis?
You know, my attempt to change the world is through kind of three tenets. One is education. I did not initially go to the University of Florida to be a lawyer, kind of backed into it, but I recognize that there are those out there who truly do want to be lawyers and have a passion for it, but just can't afford it. So I have committed funds from the book and from the foundation that I'll contribute to personally. I've endowed a scholarship at the University of Florida Law School for graduates of HBCUs to be able to afford law school. So that's one tenet. The other tenet is housing. I've recognized that in dealing with the farmers, they not only lost their land, but their house and their housing and kind of the whole family structure. And one of the ways I believe to invest in the family structure is if you have a home that you all own that you can call home, I think that kids do better in school and spouses get along better. So we've invested in a transition home that will aid those families who are looking to get into their own home ownership by letting them live there for 6 months, giving them some financial literacy, teaching them about credit, and ultimately at the end of those 6 months, giving them back the rent that they paid as a down payment for a home. So it's kind of the second tenet. And then the third tenet is really farming. And it is my goal to provide education and information to young people. Lot African-American, but just young people, period, on the field of agriculture, not just farming. It's not, you know, it's evolved now to where it's not just putting seeds in the ground, but there's hydroponic farming. There, all different types of farming. There's the business of farming. Currently, in Florida, we throw away millions of tons of food, of produce that is produced that never makes it to market, while at the same time, we import 51% of all of our food here, mm-hmm. but we're throwing this other food away. There's a disconnect there.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that I think should be addressed, and I'm attempting to address going forward.
Very, very inspiring. When did you realize the power of capital?
Power of capital became important to me as I have, I guess, matured. As a student, did not necessarily play a role with me as a, you know, in grade school, it did not necessarily play a role with me. But as I got to college, I started realizing how important capital was and how capital a lot of times is tied to opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you have the opportunity to do and to try and to fail? Do you have those opportunities? And the older I've gotten, the more I've recognized the, you know, the power of capital. I understand as an entrepreneur now how important it is to have capital, have access to capital going forward. So it's not something that I necessarily grew up knowing or understanding completely. But as I became more of an entrepreneur and a professional, it became more real to me.
You said something that triggered a thought that we don't often think about here in the U.S., but you just said an entrepreneur and actually the opportunity to fail.
Right.
We do some stuff outside the U.S. The laws aren't that way.
Right.
In fact, if you fail, it's a mark against you for life.
Right.
So even that concept, we take for granted the U.S. We have a system that allows you to go take a risk. It doesn't work out. You're going to feel it, but you still can come back. Like that in and of itself is an amazing, amazing opportunity.
One of the things that I think one of the greatest parts of America is that it doesn't matter how you go to bed tonight. Tomorrow, you got another chance.
Mm-hmm.
You have another chance at whatever it is you're seeking, but you have another chance. As you said, in many different societies and countries, you don't. Once you failed or you've made that mistake, that's it. You don't have another chance. But in America, you have those chances. And very few people, you know, hit it right, you know, every time, you know, all the way through. Yeah, I think that's one of the greatest parts of America is that opportunity.
What does stewardship mean to you?
As a father, as a business owner, I recognize that stewardship means that the buck stops with me, starts and stops with me. That I am responsible for providing for my family. And when I say my family, not even necessarily my immediate family. I am now probably the patriarch of my family because I have five sisters and mm-hmm. no brothers. My stepfather has passed away and so has my father. So I'm responsible for ensuring that they have, my family has an opportunity. They have the opportunity to fail. And in business, I also understand that I'm responsible for all of those in my office who rely on me and their families rely on me. And I take that responsibility very serious. Then finally, look, the Lord has been good to me. He's been very good to me and he's blessed me financially in many different ways. But I also understand that, you know, that's really still not my money. It's not my capital, but it is, I'm but a vessel that he has provided to redistribute that money.
And what's interesting, I would submit that when you can view yourself in the light that you just described and you hold on to your capital loosely, there's a joy and freedom that can flow from that.
Absolutely. You know, I don't know how far I can go on the podcast with this, but when I started paying my tithes consistently, no matter what the number was, because the number could get, not ridiculous, but the number could get to be up there at times, and my wife would look at me and my friends who kind of had an inkling would look at me differently, never had a problem financially. Never had a problem. Not that there haven't been ups and downs, but not anything, you know, that where I just could not provide for my family. So I take that and that responsibility very serious.
What's interesting is what you just described, totally believe in that. I actually feel called to encourage people to say, look, you're being generous with your charitable capital, which I would argue is almost a discipline.
Right.
Where I think I have been called is to go in and to challenge and provide opportunities for people to have a similar mindset on their investment capital and say, no, you actually can invest for yourself and for others. And I think it even unlocks this joy and freedom at an even deeper level because that's what we hold on to even more so than our charitable capital.
I agree with you 100%. I think that many people are misguided in understanding that you can invest and be a positive investment, do good at the same time. For me, that has been my mantra going forward is, as an entrepreneur, yes, I want to make money. Yes, I want to be successful, but I also want to make a difference.
Yep.
And that's why I say, you know, when you asked me earlier about where I am in life, it's about making a difference. It's about showing my kids who are 17 and 14, hey, it's not just about money, but you have to invest in the community and be invested in the community, because that's why it's a community. Yep. You have to participate.
Well, and I think COVID, I think the political unrest that we saw last year, I think the social unrest, my belief is the outcome of that, it's not fixed, but I think more and more people are recognizing what you just said.
Right.
Is that we need each other. We need community. And so I'm hopeful that what started last year, I mean, I'm sure it's much deeper than that. We're seeing even in our business from an investment perspective, a switch has been flipped. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
And people are now starting to say in a much bigger way, no, I want to be part of the solution. I want my capital to be connected to things I care about. Right. So in the midst of the darkness that it's easy to see, we actually are seeing glimmers of light, and it's like, whoa, it's amazing what's happening.
Well, you know, Jeff, what I think it is, it goes back to that awareness. And if we go all the way back to, you know, the civil rights movement was not necessarily getting a lot of traction until there were news reports of German shepherds and fire hoses and that type of thing. And then people became aware, oh my goodness, it's really that. With George Floyd, it would have been a totally different case if there was no one filming that.
Yep.
But to actually, and it took me almost a month after to even watch the video. But once you watch the video, you're like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. And I think that is what America's had another oh my goodness moment, and understand that they need to be a part of the solution.
Well, and look, being totally transparent, I haven't watched the full video to this day.
Right.
And I've seen snippets of it. And part of it is, as a white man, I feel like I've just been beaten up.
Right.
And that's no excuse for not being more engaged in that. But I get beaten down as a white guy.
Right.
About how bad I am.
Right.
And so I appreciate your comment. I don't know that I'll go watch it because I've seen enough.
Right.
It didn't take me, but it's like, yeah, that's horrible.
And that's why I look forward to and enjoy conversations with someone who has a different perspective than me, a different experience. And as we talked about before, we're not going to agree on everything.
Yep.
But I bet if we sat down and we made a list of it, the things we agree on are greatly outweigh the things that we disagree on, or how to fix the problem.
All right, we're going to wrap this up because we have taken way more time than I normally do, but that's because it's been so rich. If you could make one dream come true for your life, what would that be?
You know, in writing this book, I never set out to be an author initially. But after giving these farmers a voice in the courtroom, I just believe that their stories needed to be told. If there was one dream that I wanted to come true, it'd be that these farmers are acknowledged for the contribution that they've given to America, and that their stories are told and told all across America, so that A, it doesn't happen again, but also B, so that they get the acknowledgement that I think that they deserve.
When I met you a month and a half ago, I asked you, how many of these books are you going to give out or do you want sold? You didn't really even know. I don't even remember what I said. I challenged it to be way bigger. So this is my small effort to try to help to get this message out. We're going to send this podcast out, and we'll send emails to all of our financial advisors that we work with. So we're going to try to help you to get the story out.
I appreciate that.
So give us one story that you would want people to hear from the book or from your experience.
The one story that was so poignant to me, and this is a farmer who ultimately was not successful in this litigation, but I was attending a meeting where we were assisting the farmers in filling out the claims forms, and I saw a very well-dressed older gentleman standing in line. It was very hot that day, and I thought it would be appropriate for me to kind of pull him out of line and sit down and aid him with his claims form. As we sat down, there were some kind of preliminary questions, you know, the name and the address of where the farm was and what did you farm and when did you farm, you know, what the crops were and that type of thing. What office did you go to try to get a loan? And he had the answers to all of those. Those flowed very, very easily from him. But one of the very last questions at the bottom of the claims form was, or near the end of the claims form was, did you complain to anyone? Because the whole theory is we can't hold you responsible unless you were on notice of it. So we had to prove notice in each and every case that, yes, this happened. Yes, I complained about it to someone.
And when you say complain, you mean complain not to your neighbor, complain to?
Complain to someone in the office for the USDA.
Okay. Okay.
Complain to the office where you applied for the loan. And he said, no. I said, well, sir, listen. It doesn't have to be the loan officer. I mean, even if it was the receptionist, just anyone in the office that we could say they had constructive notice of your claim. And he said, son, I didn't do that. Mm. He said, I wouldn't give them that satisfaction.
Mm.
And I said, well, sir, you're not going to be successful in this claims form. And he slid it his way. And I said, but you have to sign here. And he signed it and got up and put on his hat and walked away. And what I realized is that his dignity was more important than any financial award he was going to get. He had come this far and had been through all the things that he had been through, but he was not going to compromise his dignity for some type of financial windfall.
That's a powerful story. A very powerful story. Thanks for sharing that. Well, I didn't mention it, but you've heard it throughout the podcast here. Just Harvest, the story of how black farmers won the largest civil rights case against the U.S. government by Greg Francis. It's out there. Where do people find this? Traditional, Amazon, all that?
Yeah, you can find the book at Target, at Amazon, or justharvestbook.com, where you can all buy the book or volunteer for any of the efforts or the initiatives that we put forward.
We appreciate the effort to get here, to communicate, but also what your life is about and what you're going to continue to do. And we'd love to champion you along the way. So thanks so much for sharing your experience.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's been a wonderful journey, and it was good to talk to you and what you're doing in terms of common good and investing and, as I say, doing good and doing well at the same time, I think is a concept that we all need to adopt.
Well, thank you very much. Don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to more fulfilling portfolios within the impact investing space and to get stories like Greg's out there to others. I'm Jeff Schaefer. We'll see you next time.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.